Hello and welcome to the reading of the Associated Press. My name is Donna Frano and today is Wednesday, August 19th, 2026. We will start with international news. This article is entitled, Zelensky's Office is Probed for Corruption as Fired Defense Minister Demands Elections. This has been written by Hannah Harahova and Barry Hatton. Ukrainian anti-corruption agencies announced Wednesday that they are investigating senior officials in President Volodymyr Zelensky's office, a day after the country's recently fired defense minister called the national elections, despite the ongoing fight against Russia's invasion. The political drama was an unwelcome distraction for Zelensky as Ukraine's war with its bigger neighbor enters into its fifth year. Investigators are conducting an operation to expose a criminal organization alleged led by a sitting and a former lawmaker involving senior officials from the presidential office and other individuals, according to a joint statement from Ukraine's National Anti-Corruption Bureau and the Specialized Anti-Corruption Prosecutor's Office. Further details would be released later, the agency said in a joint statement. The revelation brought another test of Zelensky's political resilience. Last year, his chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, resigned and was later named as a suspect in a major graft probe and the biggest threat to Zelensky's government since Russia's invasion in February of 2022. Zelensky is already under pressure over his firing last month of Defense Minister Mykhailo Fedorov, one of the longest-standing members of his team and a close ally since he helped Zelensky win the 2019 presidential election. Zelensky, seeking to reconcile tensions between the defense ministry's young and tech-savvy innovators and Ukraine's seasoned Soviet-trained battlefield leaders, risked angering both sides by reshuffling his wartime leadership. He ousted both Fedorov, whose changes to military procurement aimed to stamp out corruption, and Commander-in-Chief General Alexander Sursky. The move sparked days of street protests in support of Fedorov. For Zelensky, it was the second time in a year that a wartime decision triggered a strong public backlash after he moved in mid-2025 to curb the powers of anti-corruption agencies. Fedorov, in a video address posted to YouTube late Tuesday, called for elections to be held in Ukraine and a bombshell statement that appeared to directly confront Zelensky, who says a ballot can't be held under the martial law that is currently in place due to the war. We must find a legal, safe, and realistic mechanism that will allow Ukraine to restore a full democratic process, even amid a prolonged war, Fedorov said. He said Ukraine is facing a systemic crisis in how it is governed, arguing that the current system is oriented toward protecting itself and resisting change. He also condemned corruption among officials without naming anyone, saying it had weakened Ukraine's ability to fight the war. Zelensky's office did not immediately comment on Fedorov's address. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who has balked at negotiating a peace deal directly with Zelensky, says the Ukrainian president is an illegitimate leader because his term expired in 2024. Fedorov published his speech hours after Ukraine's parliament received a submission from Zelensky nominating Yevgeny Kamara as the new defense minister. Lawmakers were due to debate the president's candidate on Wednesday. The political disarray comes after recent successes in the war for Ukraine. Using its innovative drone technology, it has repeatedly hit Russian oil facilities, causing fuel shortages. It has also shocked the Russian public by striking warehouses of Wildberries, Russia's biggest online retailer, and stalled frontline advances by Russia's bigger army. But Zelensky has been unable to get traction in U.S.-led peace efforts, and Ukraine is at the mercy of Russia's ballistic missiles because more U.S.-made Patriot interceptors aren't available due to low international stockpiles. In its latest strike on oil facilities, a drone hit an oil refinery in Ufa, and Russia's Bashkortostan, its governor, Rady Khabirov was quoted as saying by Russia's state news agency RIA Novosti. The city of Ufa is located roughly 800 miles east of the border with Ukraine. There are three oil refineries in Ufa, and all three have been attacked before. Russian air defenses overnight intercepted 453 Ukrainian drones over multiple Russian regions, as well as occupied Crimea and the Black Sea, the defense ministry in Moscow said Wednesday. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, a Russian drone attacked a minibus in the southern Kherson region on Wednesday morning, killing four people, said Alexander Protikin, head of the Kherson Regional Military Administration. Four women were also wounded in the strike and were hospitalized, he said. Also, a Russian drone struck a civilian car in Kherson City, the region's capital, on Wednesday, killing a woman, said Alexander Prudikin, head of the Kherson Regional Military Administration. Our next article is entitled, A Warehouse Burns Near Moscow. In Ukraine, drone crews prepare to strike again. This has been written by Ephraim Lukatsky. Waves of Ukrainian drones targeted the massive logistics center outside Moscow overnight. The next morning, it was still ablaze, dark smoke rising into the sky from what was one of Russia's largest retail warehouses. Hundreds of miles away, Ukrainian drone crews had barely paused after the night's work before starting to prepare for another attack. A small group of soldiers quickly assembled in a sunflower field in southern Ukraine, gathering around 20 small plane-like drones laden with explosives before launching them toward Russia. The launch by the Ukrainian 413th Raid Unmanned Systems Regiment on Sunday morning was observed by a team of Associated Press journalists, a rare glimpse into a rapidly expanding part of Ukraine's war effort. It's Ukraine's latest tactic, long-range drones designed to carry the war deep inside Russia, striking military, industrial, and logistical sites far from the front line. Kyiv has stepped up its attacks on Russia this year with long-range missiles and swarms of drones targeting military industries and energy facilities. It has also increasingly pummeled giant Wildberries depots, burning billions of dollars worth of merchandise belonging to the Russian online retail giant. Those attacks have brought the war home to the Russian public nearly 4.5 years into Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The scale of the attacks has also forced Russia's military to stretch air defenses over a larger area, disrupted airports, sparked fuel shortages, and undermined morale in Russia. The regiment's commander, Yevhen Karas, said his unit had also taken part hours earlier in the strike on the Wildberries warehouse, about 28 miles south of Moscow, during one of Ukraine's largest attacks on Russia to date. Ukraine will need to punish the Kremlin if we want to get a stable and long period of peace and normal peace, Karas said. The bigger casualties they have, the sooner they will go for peace, he added. Kyiv officials aim to make the Russian public feel the war's consequences and pressure Russian President Vladimir Putin into negotiating a peace settlement. Putin has so far shown no signs he intends to end the war. Karas, however, believes the impact of Ukraine's long-range strike campaign on Russia's economy is bringing home the cost of the war to ordinary Russians, and hopes this will drive Moscow back to the negotiating table after months of U.S.-brokered talks between the two sides stalled. On Sunday morning, before the drones took to the skies, Karas took out a black marker and wrote a message on the fuselage, "Moscow burns under the sky. Red flame rises so warm and high. Dark smoke moves above the town. Fire lights the night all around." Like the majority of Ukraine's serving military, Karas had had a very different life before Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24, 2022. But on that day, the 38-year-old who majored in philosophy in his university studies and his brother Vladimir both volunteered for the front. His brother was killed while defending the Kyiv region. In the months that follows, followed Karas rose through the ranks to become an officer in Ukraine's Special Operations Forces. In 2024, Karas was appointed commander of the newly formed 413th Raid Unmanned Systems Regiment, which began as a unit using drones for reconnaissance and other battlefield tasks. As drone technology developed and flight range increased from hundreds to over 1,000 miles, his unit was tasked with mounting long-range operations using Ukraine's domestically produced FP-1 drones against targets deep inside Russia. Others in the unit include a former opera singer, a computer programmer, a rapper, and a cellist. Their routine now focuses on a very simple sequence of tasks. Prepare the drone, check the systems, move it into position, and launch. Wait for the result, then repeat. The unit's medallion, something militaries across the world refer to as a challenge coin, carries the troops' insignia on one side, a stylized three-prong arrow. On the other is a relief depiction of a Kremlin in flames with a drone flying over it. Karas said that in this phase of the war, Moscow should fear the skies. Muscovites should spend their nights in their wonderful metro, just as residents of Kiev have spent years going underground to escape Russian missile and drone attacks, Karas said. Back in the sunflower field, once the drones were airborne, the soldiers packed up their equipment and drove away, leaving hardly any traces of their activity. They were on to the next launch site. Our next article is entitled, Jason Arday's Death Sparks UK Debate Over Academic Rigor, Racism After Media Frenzy. This has been written by Danica Kirka. In 2012, a smiling Jason Arday was photographed by the British press carrying the Olympic flame and the torch relay that preceded the London Games. He was back in the news in 2023 when Cambridge University hailed him as the youngest black professor in the institution's history. 3 years later, after weeks of news stories presenting evidence that he was a plagiarist and a fabulist, Arday, 41, was found dead on Friday at his apartment in South London. His death quickly led to a blame game. Cambridge has been criticized for elevating Arday in a rush to promote diversity, despite red flags about his qualifications, and the news media has been targeted for driving him to despair when his credentials and life story began to unravel under intense scrutiny. James Cleverly, a black member of parliament who held cabinet positions in past governments, said a number of universities failed to do the proper due diligence on Arday. We now see that he was not completely honest and that he had frailties and failings, Cleverly told The Times Radio. But he was teed up by a number of academic institutions because they desperately wanted a wunderkind. They desperately wanted to play in the fact that he was young and black and good-looking, and they wanted him to be their poster child. But Patrick Vernon, who was recently knighted for his work on racial equality, is focused on the media. Coverage of the Arday story was out of proportion to his position in society, reflecting the higher standard to which people of color are held when compared with their white peers, Vernon said. The level of scrutiny that the late Professor Jason Arday faced was unprecedented, Vernon said. He's not the prime minister of this country. He's not a current secretary of the civil service or local government or the National Health Service or chief executive of a major PLC. But he was treated at the same standard, which is outrageous, Vernon said. Cambridge hired Arday as a professor of sociology of education in February of 2023, when he was 37. In announcing the appointment, Cambridge highlighted his place as the youngest black professor in the university's history and described him as a respected scholar, focusing on increasing the representation of black, Asian, and other minorities in higher education. Arday received this stature, the university said, even though he was born with a form of autism spectrum disorder that left him unable to speak until he was 11 and unable to read or write until his late teens. aspects of his biography that have since been questioned in new stories. British universities have been working to hire more academics from racial and ethnic minority backgrounds so that their faculties better reflect the broader society. There were 270 black professors at UK universities during the 2024-2025 academic year, up from 120 in 2016 to 2017, according to data published by the Society for Research into Higher Education. Black scholars still represent just 1% of all UK professors, even though black people make up about 4% of the working age population, the data shows. Questions about Arday's qualifications became public last month. Nathan Kofnaz, a one-time Cambridge researcher who left the university after his vitriolic comments about diversity programs and minorities sparked widespread protest, said he had found evidence of plagiarism in Arday's PhD thesis. The Times of London and other newspapers picked up the story, publishing an analysis of the thesis and highlighting multiple passages they said were identical or near identical to an earlier paper by another academic. The news media also questioned Arday's claims about astounding personal accomplishments, such as running 30 marathons in 35 days and raising $7.4 million for charity over 20 years. The public scrutiny was partly fueled by the impending publication of Arday's memoir, Great and Unfortunate Things. Simon & Schuster published the book last week in the U.S., and it is scheduled to be published in the U.K. on August 27th. After initially standing by Arday, Cambridge said August 5th that it was opening an investigation after receiving new information about his qualifications. Arday resigned later that day. The University of Glasgow and Durham University, where Arday previously taught, have announced their own investigations. The ceremonial head of Cambridge on Sunday defended the university's decision and criticized media coverage of Arday. "I do believe it is possible to hold to two principles at the same time, to believe in the importance of academic integrity and where criticisms of plagiarism arise about any academic, whoever they are, ensure that they are rigorously investigated and also refuse to join a racist feeding frenzy over a particular academic," Chancellor Chris Smith told the BBC. By Tuesday afternoon, more than 107,000 people had signed an open letter calling on the government to commission a public inquiry into media coverage of Arday. The letter alleges that media organizations kept up their coverage of Arday even after Simon Baron Cohen, director of Cambridge University's Autism Research Center, publicly warned that their focus on a vulnerable autistic man raised safeguarding issues. Circulated by the Good Law Project, a campaign group, the letter says Arday and other prominent black people have been subject to press harassment with racist overtones. Stephen Barnett, a professor of communications at the University of Westminster, put the onus on British newspapers, not social media. The mainstream press published 289 stories about Arday in 22 days, almost two-thirds of them after he resigned, Barnett said. "No one should doubt that he was overwhelmed by the scrutiny because Arday himself said it was more than anyone could bear," Barnett said. "I don't think it's possible to overestimate the impact that those newspapers, those publishers have had in this particular case," he said. Charles Moore, a former editor of the Daily Telegraph who writes about education, rejected that criticism in a column on Monday. "If Cambridge had properly investigated concerns about Arday that surfaced as early as 2023, he wouldn't have suffered the shame caused by widespread media coverage," Moore wrote. Rather than trumpeting Arday's position as the university's youngest ever black professor, Cambridge could quietly have nurtured his talents and sorted out his problems, which were surely those of a young man out of his depth, rather than a brazen imposter, he said. "It was the university, not the press, which was obsessed with the color of Dr. Arday's skin," Moore wrote. Sarah Didham, writing in the Times of London, said Arday was a legitimate news story because his actions hurt the academics he plagiarized, public confidence and the rigor of his discipline in other early career lecturers against whom he competed. But she acknowledged that the story was given extra oxygen because it broke during the summer when Parliament is closed and journalists are desperate for something to write about. Academic plagiarists don't usually make headlines, but Arday was not any old academic, Didem wrote. He was publishing a high-profile memoir with celebrity blurbs, she added. He had chosen the spotlight. Vernon, meanwhile, is encouraging people to remember that there was a man, a husband, and father behind the headlines. He has created a GoFundMe campaign to help Arday's family that has already raised more than $261,000. This tells you that Britain still cares about justice. They care about inequalities, he said. And more importantly, they really want to support Jason and his family in their hour of need. Our next article is entitled, South Korean and U.S. Militaries Shorten Drills by About Half After Trump Ordered a Reduction. This has been written by Hyung Jin Kim. The South Korean and U.S. militaries confirmed Wednesday they were significantly scaling back major joint drills days after President Donald Trump ordered the reduction in an apparent bid to reengage with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Trump had ordered his Pentagon chief to substantially reduce the allies' summertime Yulchi Freedom Shield exercises just before they began Monday for an 11-day run. Trump cited what he said was a good relationship with Kim and South Korea's refusal to support him over Iran. South Korean officials said Trump's surprise announcement came without prior notice, baffling many people in the Asian country and raising concerns about joint defense readiness. South Korea's military said Wednesday the allies agreed to adjust the duration and scale of the exercises at the request of the United States. It said the ongoing drills would end Friday, not August 27th, as initially planned. It added the allies also agreed to downsize some joint field training exercises. The Pentagon said it was continuing training that enhances tactical capability, but certain events have been canceled or converted to simulations. These adjustments preserve essential readiness and training objectives. There will be no degradation to U.S. training objectives, a Pentagon statement said. Many experts say Trump's move threatens to hurt the combined U.S.-South Korean defense posture and eventually weaken their decades-long alliance. A reduction or suspension of military drills matters because military commanders change periodically. A one-year suspension of drills would mean commanders unfamiliar with the procedures of the drills would be taking part when they resume, according to Yang Yuk, an analyst at Seoul's Asian Institute for Policy Studies. Yulchi Freedom Shield is largely a computer-simulated command post exercise meant to hone the allies' ability to deal with potential North Korean aggression. The two countries usually hold a set of field training exercises during the command post exercise period. The drills and a similar springtime exercise are a central pillar of the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which dates to the 1950-1953 Korean War. But it's also a long-running source of tensions with North Korea, which has denounced the exercises as a rehearsal for an invasion and responded with provocative missile tests. Days before the month's drills began, North Korea launched two ballistic missiles into the sea. This month's drills were initially supposed to be held in two phases in simulation of North Korean attacks. The first part until this Friday on defensive operations, and the second part until August 27th on counteroffensive operations. North Korea is extremely sensitive to counteroffensive drills, according to South Korean media. North Korea hasn't responded to Trump's overture, but earlier Wednesday, its state news agency, KCNA, published a commentary slamming the U.S.-South Korean military drills as frantic and extremely dangerous, and vowing to completely frustrate its rivals' hostilities. the dangerous escalation of the war drills staged by the U.S. and its vassal forces is posing a more serious threat to the security of North Korea, the commentary said. Our exercise of right to self-defense will continue to completely neutralize the enemy's military threat. Many experts say Kim, now emboldened by his advancing nuclear program and expanding military cooperation with Russia, won't likely embrace Trump's overture and return to talks anytime soon unless he's promised bigger concessions. In response to Trump's previous outreach, Kim suggested last year that they can only return to talks if the U.S. drops its demand for North Korean denuclearization as a precondition for diplomacy. Trump and Kim met three times from 2018 to 2019, but their high-stakes diplomacy eventually fell apart over wrangling over a North Korean demand for extensive sanctions relief and return for limited denuclearization steps. On Monday, the office of South Korean President Lee Jae-myung expressed hope that a friendly relationship between Trump and Kim would lead to meaningful dialogue to promote peace on the Korean Peninsula. Lee is a liberal who wants better ties with North Korea. But his office's statement drew a strong backlash from conservatives who alleged Lee's government was prioritizing the resumption of Kim-Trump diplomacy over safety concerns caused by Trump's move. In a social media post, Trump said that he said the drills are not only costly, but send a signal that is totally inappropriate and hostile to North Korea, which he said has been unthreatening and respectful during his time in the White House. Trump said he asked Lee if South Korea would join the U.S. in the denuclearization of Iran, and they said no thanks. At separate parliamentary hearings Wednesday, South Korean Foreign Minister Cho Hyun and Defense Ministry An Kyo-bak said neither South Korea nor U.S. officials were informed of Trump's move before his social media post. Cho said the alliance remains strong, while An said South Korean and U.S. defense officials were maintaining close consultations. Some experts say Trump's cut of the drills was more likely designed to apply pressure on South Korea to give him substantial support over the Iran war than to reach out to North Korea. Trump's message is that if you don't cooperate with us on Iran, we're not cooperating with you on the drills either, said Yang, the analyst. It's like he's asking South Korea to show it's helping him over Iran by taking steps like sending warships or reinforcing missile defenses in some areas. South Korean officials said South Korea and the U.S. are closely discussing practical and military contributions that South Korea can make to help restore freedom of navigation in the Strait of Hormuz. It wasn't the first time that the United States and South Korea have scaled back or canceled their drills. In 2018, Trump abruptly announced the cancellation of a major war game with South Korea after his first summit with Kim. Announcing the decision, Trump said suspending the provocative war games would save us a tremendous amount of money. The U.S. and South Korea have since canceled or reduced other joint drills to support diplomacy with North Korea and cope with the COVID-19 pandemic. Experts say reducing those drills has undermined the combined South Korea-U.S. readiness. Our next article is entitled, Congo's Ebola outbreak reaches 5,000 cases as it outpaces response efforts at unprecedented speed. This has been written by Chinedu Aswadu and Constance Sam Bagalwa. The Ebola outbreak in Congo has reached 5,000 cases, government data showed Wednesday, as responders warn it is spreading at an unprecedented speed, outpacing efforts to slow it in one of the country's remotest regions. Data from Congo's Ministry of Health showed the outbreak had so far recorded 5,021 cases, including 2,378 deaths as of Sunday, as it rages in some of the most challenging conditions imaginable, fueled by insecurity, displacement, and intense population movements. The outbreak has infected and killed more people at a greater speed than any other outbreak in history. The World Health Organization estimates it would likely surpass the outbreak of 2014 to 2016 across West Africa, which was the deadliest Ebola outbreak on record, with more than 11,000 deaths. Starting from the first detected case, the current outbreak has spread about three times faster than the deadliest on record. The outbreak has spread rapidly, and the risk of further national and international spread remains high, World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said Tuesday at a meeting convened by the agency. "We must be frank. The epidemic is far from being under control," he said. Therese Anaya, a nurse working in Ituri's capital, Bunia, said she is exhausted by the work demands and poor working conditions. Some health workers have gone on strike after not being paid. "If the managers don't take things seriously, we too will end up withdrawing. The way this epidemic is being managed is exhausting," Anaya told the Associated Press. A key challenge has been the lack of approved vaccines or treatments for the rare Bundibugyo virus, which is responsible for the current outbreak. Most new cases are being reported outside of the people being monitored, showing it has spread quickly and left surveillance teams racing to catch up. Ituri, the province that has been hit the worst by the outbreak, has become a primary location for violence that has limited the response as health workers are targeted. Residents on Monday attacked a health team in the territory of Aru after a suspected case was reported there. A mob set fire to an ambulance and damaged two other vehicles, according to Michael Wani, president of the Union of Cultural Associations for the Development of Ituri. Dr. Martin Quinaway, who is involved in the Ituri response efforts, explained it is essential to bring the response closer to the people, particularly in rural mining and displacement areas. Trish Newport, an emergency coordinator with Doctors Without Borders, known by its French acronym MSF, said not all the people in the impacted areas have the essential information they need. "The community needs to be aware about the outbreak. They need to be involved in the response. They need to know what the signs and symptoms are and what to do if they get sick," Newport said. Experts believe the virus began spreading from the mining town of Mongbaula as early as February, months before authorities declared the outbreak on May 15th. Responders racing to catch up are also battling several other challenges, including threats by rebel groups, anger from communities that have been traumatized for years, and bad roads into the affected territories. Although the 2014-2016 outbreak is considered the deadliest among the virus types that cause Ebola disease, government data shows this Bundibugyo outbreak has killed a higher percentage of people as care and support are not getting to patients quickly enough, while many are not reporting symptoms or doing so late. The situation also varies across the six affected provinces. While the case fatality rate is so far 47.4%, it is far worse in some places where response efforts are more challenging, such as in North Kivu province, where the fatality rate is 70%. Our next article is entitled, "In Israel, Military Service Debate Spotlights Ultra-Orthodox Jews and Their Growing Clout." This has been written by Giovanna Del Orta. Ultra-Orthodox Jewish families are an unmissable facet of Israeli life, immediately recognizable. The men dress in black suits and hats, the women in modest long sleeves and skirts with wigs, turbans, or scarves covering their hair, and numerous children tag along, often in matching outfits. They are growing in numbers and political and cultural clout. That's bringing their vision of faith, Jewish identity, and civic practices into conflict with other Israelis, both religious and secular. Distrust spirals on all sides. Mass protest over proposed changes to the exemption from the military draft for ultra-Orthodox men might highlight the most contentious issue as the country approaches 3 years of war on multiple fronts, and national elections where ultra-Orthodox parties are likely to be kingmakers. At the core of ultra-Orthodox doctrine is the belief that studying scripture and teaching it to family and community is the highest duty, above working or joining the armed forces even in wartime. Judith Rosenblum, who has 7 sons and 1 daughter, believes that ultra-Orthodox practice is under threat from secular culture and that conscripting young men into the military can compromise their religious practice. But when she ran into an acquaintance whose grandsons lost 2 legs and an arm in the war in Gaza, she was proud to relay that 3 of her sons also signed up to serve after the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. If all of my kids were cut out for full-time Torah learning and had the money to support themselves doing so, for sure that would be a preference, Rosenblum said. But my kids who left full-time Torah study are amazing human beings, and I believe that they did the right thing by going into the army and participating in the defense of the country. In Hebrew, the ultra-Orthodox are called Haredim. The term was first used in the late 19th century by several rabbis and is derived from the prophet Isaiah's description of being fearful or astounded by the word of God, according to Rabbi Beryl Gershenfeld. God's word is not supposed to be intuitive. You have to look deeply, said Gershenfeld, who grew up in Philadelphia but has lived in Israel studying and teaching the Torah for half a century. Understanding the Torah is the crucial mission of life. He runs 2 Jerusalem yeshivas, or seminaries, for ultra-Orthodox boys and men. Such institutions are the beating heart of the community, said Rabbi Heshi Grossman, an administrator at a prominent yeshiva in the Jerusalem neighborhood of Ramat. Inside the residential yeshiva, students aged 17 to 22 in white shirts and black pants spend long days praying, studying, and discussing sacred texts and commentaries. Edel Lovi, 22, is completing his 5 years of study at the age when families start matchmaking for marriage. We have a lot of belief in what we're learning, he said, a day before the start of summer break. Lovi enthusiastically described how days begin at 7 a.m. with a prayer and continue with Talmud studies until late evening, learning all commands from God and how to get close to him. As he took a sip of water on the hot day, he whispered a prayer. Everything comes from the one above, he explained with a smile. For the ultra-Orthodox, each commandment and each good deed is not just a God-given obligation, but a way to find fulfillment and holiness. And the highest one is studying God's word, especially for men. Women receive a broader education in secular subjects like math, and they are expected to work while also raising large families. Ultra-Orthodox Jews believe many forms of birth control are opposed to God's will, a view held by other conservative faiths, but not all branches of Judaism. My life is not about making money or building a nice house, said Lovi, who plans to continue to study the Torah while his future wife works. For the ultra-Orthodox, every second of life is devoted to God, said Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, adding that other Jews will either follow suit or disappear into the mainstream. The Orthodox are fighting assimilation, said Feldman, who in his late 90s has witnessed the growth of the practice and still writes columns for a popular Haredi weekly magazine. If you don't study Torah and observe the commands, you become like any other Mediterranean country. He added that ultra-Orthodox follow civil law so long as it doesn't interfere with religious belief, such as forbidding or affecting the study of the Torah. Much of the Torah study traditions was lost during the Holocaust. When the State of Israel was founded shortly after, it gave ultra-Orthodox scholars special rights so they could rebuild, said Shlomit Revitsky Terpaz, director of the Israel Democracy Institute's Religion and State Program. That included an exemption from the military draft, originally for a few hundred scholars and in later decades broadened by conservative governments to everyone who wanted to engage in Torah, learning full-time, she said, the same body of men who was also largely outside the workforce. But the ultra-Orthodox have grown rapidly, outpacing other Israelis. Revitsky Terpaz estimates they will be about 25% of the population by 2050 and about 40% of the potential army draft. Israelis aren't concerned about the Haredi way of life. They're concerned about their way of life, she said, adding that includes everything from welfare tax impacts to how much time non-Haredi Israelis might need to serve in the reserves. The question is, who's paying the price for your choice of life? This has become the issue everyone is talking about. For many ultra-Orthodox, there's no debate. They're fulfilling their individual obligation to God, and nothing else matters more. The importance of the Torah is a genuine feeling and not just an escape, not just an excuse, Rosenblum said. Haredi world will put Torah first and then Israel. Fewer than 10% of ultra-Orthodox men reaching the conscription age of 18 enlist, according to a parliamentary committee, and they usually join separate units, accommodating their religious practices. Reacting to a recent bill protecting the ultra-Orthodox from draft evasion prosecution, the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Eyal Zamir, calls such exemptions inconceivable while troops are being asked for unprecedented sacrifice. But most ultra-Orthodox rabbis are adamant about their youth's exemption from the draft to avoid diluting their piety at a critical age. The Jewish men in Israel are required to serve for nearly 3 years and women for 2 years. Studying the Torah is itself a spiritual protection, Feldman added, an argument wearing thin with many Israelis, especially since about 1,000 troops have been killed fighting Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah militants in Lebanon since the 2023 attack. Asked if he had any qualms about his peers serving as soldiers while he devotes his life to studies, Lovi, the yeshiva student, said he prays all the time for the soldiers. But we think because we believe in the Bible, we believe this is the right way to live. We don't apologize, he said. I am doing what God wants. And now we turn to our domestic news. This article is entitled, Prosecutors Say Bullet Engravings Show Charlie Kirk Was Targeted for His Politics. This has been written by Hannah Schoenbaum. Prosecutors in Charlie Kirk's killing pointed Tuesday to an engraved bullet, arguing that the inscription, "Hey Fascist, Catch," demonstrates that Kirk was targeted for how the defendant perceived his politics. Whether defendant Tyler Robinson acted out of political animus could be key for prosecutors seeking the death penalty or for his attorneys in taking the punishment off the table. The prosecution and defense have filed dueling documents focused on whether the crime included aggravating factors that would make Robinson eligible for the death penalty if convicted. Those include political targeting and whether the shooting endangered thousands of others who attended Kirk's September 10th event at Utah Valley University. Robinson is charged with crimes including aggravated murder and has not yet entered a plea. The 23-year-old defendant turned himself in a day after the shooting. The latest batch of court documents follows a 5-day preliminary hearing in July when prosecutors presented what they said was overwhelming evidence against Robinson, while defense attorneys worked to sow doubt about analysts' findings. Judge Tony Graff said he will decide if the case should advance to trial after he hears again from both sides on September 1st. In a document filed late Tuesday, prosecutors argued the engraved bullet found in the suspected murder weapon was an overt political reference. They also noted that Robinson allegedly wrote in a text message about Kirk, "I had enough of his hatred. Some hate can't be negotiated out." Robinson's attorneys have argued that the text message is not strong enough evidence to prove a political motivation. They did not immediately respond to a request for comment on prosecutors' new filing. Before his death, Kirk and the organization he co-founded, Turning Point USA, galvanized the conservative youth vote to help President Donald Trump win a second term. Prosecutors contend that Kirk's opposition to same-sex marriage and gender-affirming care stood in sharp contrast to Robinson, who was reportedly in a romantic relationship with his roommate, Lance Twiggs. Twiggs told investigators he had considered a gender transition around the time of Kirk's killing, according to prosecutors. A handwritten note that prosecutors allege Robinson left for Twiggs read in part, I had the opportunity to take out Charlie Kirk, and I took it. In a recorded interview shown in court last month, Twiggs said he had never heard Robinson talk about Kirk before the shooting. Robinson also did not talk much about gender issues or LGBTQ plus rights, but he did sometimes talk about politics involving Trump, Twiggs told investigators. The Associated Press emailed Twiggs' attorney seeking comment. During the July hearing, investigators presented DNA analysis that they said linked Robinson to both the suspected murder weapon and a tool he allegedly used to engrave the bullet cartridges. Robinson's attorneys repeatedly questioned the reliability of DNA tests and other evidence. Defense attorneys also have argued against a possible sentence enhancement for endangering others, saying the shooter hit the intended target. Prosecutors said numerous people were within a zone of danger around Kirk when he was shot from a rooftop. Our next article is entitled, Amazon Set to Expand Drone Delivery of Lightweight Packages to 500 U.S. Cities. This has been written by Josh Funk. Millions more people may be able to get smaller, lightweight Amazon packages delivered by drones by the end of the year, under a plan the company announced Thursday to expand the airborne shipping to suburban areas in nearly 500 U.S. cities. Customers could receive the drone deliveries in as fast as 30 minutes, Amazon said in a news release. The drones can carry packages up to 5 pounds. The plan will intensify the battle between Amazon and Walmart to provide consumers with the fastest delivery times. Both giants rely on a mix of drones and drivers to deliver everything consumers have ordered. Amazon's plan would expand its drone delivery operation more than sixfold nationwide into hundreds of new communities, including the Chicago, Atlanta, Cleveland, and Boise metro areas. The drones will primarily fly in the suburbs well away from skyscrapers and major airports that could cause problems. Hundreds of thousands of packages have already been delivered by Amazon drones this year, but even after this expansion, drones will still only handle a fraction of the hundreds of millions of package deliveries each year. In addition to only being able to carry 5 pounds, the drones Amazon builds face countless challenges, from tree cover to landscaping and inflatable pools that can make it hard to find a good drop zone. They are also regulatory hurdles to overcome in every community where Amazon wants to set up operations. Noise concerns also pose a potential challenge. It's still an experiment. It's still in test and learn mode, said Sucharita Kadali, who is a retail analyst with Forrester. Initially, consumers might order something delivered by drone because they are curious about it, but it's not clear how often they will continue to use the service, and Amazon is still working out the economics, Kadali said. The service will be free for Amazon Prime members who are ordering more than $50 worth of goods, but smaller orders will cost members $2.99. Non-members will pay $4.99 for drone delivery. Prime members get free deliveries while non-members pay a flat fee if the shipment is under $35 for standard delivery or up to $12.99 for same-day shipments when available. Kadali said drones could prove more useful for certain lightweight deliveries that are needed urgently, like prescription medications. DoorDash and other delivery companies also are experimenting with using drones to deliver food and other goods. Amazon CEO Andy Jassy told shareholders in his annual letter in April that the company has learned a great deal by flying drones in 11 sites across Arizona, Florida, Kansas, Louisiana, Michigan, Nebraska, and Texas. In each location, the drones launch from an Amazon warehouse and cover about 175 square miles. So it takes multiple drone launching locations to serve a large metro area. Prime Air now has a design that'll scale, plans to serve communities with 30 million customers by year end, and expects to deliver 500 million packages by the end of this decade, with an aim to deliver inside 30 minutes, Jassy wrote. Amazon is also continuing to invest in its warehouses, smaller fulfillment centers closer to customers, and its fleet of trucks as the company competes to deliver packages within minutes or hours instead of just days. Amazon is already certified by the Federal Aviation Administration, and the company has been awarded waivers to fly drones beyond the line of sight of the pilots. Amazon has invested in safety measures to help drones avoid collisions with anything else in the sky while they are making deliveries. The federal government has proposed a rule that would allow more drone operators to fly beyond the horizon, but that hasn't been finalized yet. Our next article is entitled, U.S. Representative Byron Donalds wins GOP nod for Florida governor against ex-Rep. David Jolly for the Democrats. This has been written by Bill Barrow. U.S. Representative Byron Donalds won the Republican nomination for Florida governor, and former Representative David Jolly picked up the Democratic nod in Tuesday's primaries, setting the stage for a fall campaign to replace outgoing Governor Ron DeSantis and decide the state's future political direction. November's election will test President Donald Trump's grip on his adopted state and Democrats' ability to resurrect Florida as a national political battleground. Florida has moved notably to the right since Trump's victory in 2016, though Democrats hope to regain ground from his slumping popularity ratings. DeSantis, a leading conservative figure who has both clashed and collaborated with Trump over the years, is barred from running for a third consecutive term. Also Tuesday, progressive state representative Angie Nixon won the Democratic nomination for a U.S. Senate special election, defeating retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a one-time National Security Council official who testified in Trump's first impeachment in 2019. Nixon, who was heavily outspent by Vindman, will face Senator Ashley Moody, winner of the Republican nomination, in November to fill the last 2 years of Marco Rubio's Senate term. Rubio left the seat to become Trump's Secretary of State last year. Donalds would be Florida's first black governor if he wins in November. He defeated a former DeSantis running mate, Lieutenant Governor Jay Collins, political newcomer James Fishback, and others Tuesday. The 47-year-old Congressman Donalds told his supporters at a Universal Studios resort hotel that he'd heard from Republican rivals who pledged their help in winning the general election. "The primary is over," Donalds said. "Tonight we put aside our differences. Tonight we are one united Republican Party." Donalds described Trump's backing as important but determinative. "Obviously, he has the strongest following of anybody in our party," he said. However, he added, "You can't just sit back and think the president's endorsement is going to carry you." Donalds has promised to push tax cuts, overhaul Florida's insurance regulations to lower consumer costs, and seek greater price transparency from healthcare providers. The Democrats' candidate for governor, Jolly, is a former Republican congressman who switched parties last year. He did not shy away from his partisan history as he addressed supporters Tuesday night. "To my Democratic friends, thank you for welcoming me into the party," he said. Jolly's speech detailed a platform that balances both political parties, an embrace of capitalism, and a lean government, but one that needs to do its part to fill the gaps, such as with education and housing. "As an old-school Republican, I talk about ending the culture wars, not to celebrate some progressive platform," he said, "but because I still believe in the old-school Republican libertarian policy that government should simply stay out of your life and stay out of your bedroom." It's the second time in a row that Democrats have nominated a one-time Republican for governor. 4 years ago, they backed former Governor Charlie Crist, only to see him lose by nearly 20 percentage points to DeSantis. Rich Chamberlain, a retiree in Port St. Lucie, said he supported Jolly in Tuesday's primary, spurred on by attack ads against him. "I saw anti-Jolly ads. I said, okay, if they are against him, then I must be for him," Chamberlain said, adding it didn't matter to him that Jolly was once a Republican. Florida voters haven't sent a Democrat to the U.S. Senate since 2012, and this year's race was always going to be an uphill climb. Moody, a former state attorney general, was appointed by DeSantis to fill Rubio's seat last year after he became Trump's Secretary of State. She's now running to finish the last 2 years of his term. Moody will face Nixon, a progressive state lawmaker who scored an upset victory over the Army veteran Vindman. Nixon would be Florida's first black U.S. senator if elected in November. Representative Nixon ran a strong campaign, Vindman posted on social media. I will be standing by her side in the fight against Ashley Moody. I hope you'll join me. In U.S. House primaries, Tuesday's biggest contest saw longtime Democratic U.S. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz defeat former U.S. Representative Sheila Cherfilas McCormick and others in a redrawn South Florida district. Wasserman Schultz, who is white, urged voters in the new plurality black district to help her return to Washington for a 12th term. Cherfilas McCormick had sought a comeback after resigning earlier this year under a pending federal indictment and threat of House ethics sanctions. Wasserman Schultz entered a new district after DeSantis' successful push for new congressional maps intended to boost Trump's midterm election prospects. Her four black primary opponents, including Cherfilas McCormick, had argued that the district should have a black representative, but the voters went with a candidate who touted long experience from serving in Congress since 2005. Surrounded by her campaign staff Tuesday night, Wasserman Schultz tearfully thanked voters for having confidence in her. She said she wanted to make all of you proud, to make sure that the people we spoke to all across this district know that I will fight so that they can pay their rent. Former television news reporter Ryan Elijah won the Republican nomination for Florida's 7th congressional district, ousting the scandal-plagued Mills. A two-term congressman, Mills has denied allegations of domestic violence against a former girlfriend and other controversies. But Florida Republicans, including DeSantis, had abandoned Mills ahead of the primary, and the congressman was not included on Trump's final list of Florida endorsements. Elijah advances to the general election in a central Florida district that is considered reliably Republican. Well, that concludes our time. Until next time, and thank you for listening.